a fiddler with the truth. Sounds crazy, no? But you could say that in our little city of Washington, D.C., every one of us is a fiddler with the truth, trying to take a position that makes everyone happy. Now you may ask, is it possible to answer a question without offending anyone? Well, yes and no. We know there are many, many poor people. So what would be so terrible if I just took a little bit more of some people's good fortune, spread it around a little bit? If I tax each rich man, oh, Solyndra, I could lend you all the cash you'd ever want. All day long, I'd piddle tidy sums if I tax each wealthy man. Oh, who cares if they work hard? Warren Buffett says to stuff it, they can tough it out, and then I would have so many, many fans if I tax salons where Boehner tans. I'd give free health insurance out by the millions, pay off the houses they foreclosed, electric cars without any tanks to fill. There would be new green fuels with jobs by the thousands. If we paid, no one would be opposed. If we forced Catholics to go on the pill, I'd start new programs where your cat could get food stamps. Class warfare lines would now be drawn. If the rich complain, I'll just raise our tax again. And as our stash goes up, I'd have extra money to pay for gay weddings from now on. But only if they play It's Raining Men. It's such a simple tax plan, 'cause the rate that's great for you and you and you and you and you will be in the budget I submit. Here's how I will get votes out of it. Your tax rate will now apply to Mitt. And I bet you 10,000 middle-class voters that if that happened, I'd be a re-elected man. Thank you.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear this program and many other wonderful programs at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area, or you can go to accesssacramento.org, or you can download this program from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Angry White Men. Sociologist Michael Kimmel has spent hundreds of hours in the company of America's angry white men, from white supremacists to men's rights activists to young students.
So the origins come from what was then called the men's liberation movement, that men needed liberation too from restrictive, constraining, oppressor roles, so
to speak.
But
which was sympathetic to feminism initially in its founding, right?
Initially it was.
Yeah, see, that was new. That was interesting. Yeah.
Initially it was sympathetic to feminism, but there was also, but as one became angry, and I think there is still a men's liberation movement, impulse, that is independent of feminism, or sees itself as independent feminism, but not anti-feminist. But that's basically faded. What has emerged now as part of the men's rights movement is that women have actually... basically, the men's rights movement takes as true the same thing I often hear from my female students, which is when I come to my classes and I start to tell them the history of sort of the gender revolution, my students say, well, feminism, that was your generation's issue. We won. Thank you so much. But we don't have to worry about that now. We can do anything we want.
The men or the women, say this?
The women say this, right? Well, why? Because, of course, they haven't been in the workplace yet.
Right.
5 years after they graduate, they come back and go, you were right. But before that, they think, you know, feminism's over and we won. So we don't need to deal with that stuff anymore. We can have as much sex as we want. We can drink as much as we want. We can like sports. We can go to law school. We're fine.
Right.
So... So, but the men had the same critique in a funny way. They basically think that feminism has been so victorious that women have basically taken over.
Mm-hmm.
And there are several ways in which the men's rights movement embraces many of the original claims of men's liberation. For example, around men's health.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before they get angry and say there's too much funding for breast cancer, not enough for prostate cancer, before they get there, they do say the traditional definition of masculinity basically means you are indifferent to health concerns. Men do not go to the doctors as often for routine screenings, mm-hmm. et cetera. All of those health issues are true,
mm-hmm.
and they come from a critique of the male sex role. And to that extent, I actually think the men's rights movement has some positive things to offer,
mm-hmm.
particularly around health,
mm-hmm.
around stress-related diseases, around mm-hmm. how masculinity leads to greater stress.
Right.
All that stuff.
We agree with that, right? Right.
Okay. So that part I agree with, that it's somehow because women have taken over the medical establishment and there's all this funding for prostate cancer. I think not.
Right.
No funding for prostate cancer.
No funding for breast cancer. Right, right.
I don't think so. But I don't blame women for this, but I do think that that critique is a reasonable one. The critique so that's one thing. I think the major tributary that feeds the river of rage on the men's rights movement has to do with a grief entitlement around fatherhood.
Right.
Father rights movement.
Right.
Was that
like a minor strand or a separate strand? Like, why did the father's rights movement come to define, and this sort of, you know, essentially I think of as bitterness about divorce.
Yeah.
Overwhelming amounts of bitterness about divorce.
And child custody. More about custody than divorce, frankly.
But it becomes, the only emails I don't answer are emails I recognize because they're so vile
right.
that it's shocking.
Okay.
You know, and so where does that, how did that all come from?
Yeah. Okay. I think it's understandable.
Mm-hmm.
In the 70s, the critique of the male sex role mm-hmm. enabled men or in some ways inspired men to become more involved fathers.
Mm-hmm.
This is where the men's liberation and women's liberation movement actually coincided.
Right.
Feminist women were saying, we need you to be better
right.
fathers.
Right.
We need you to be, you know, share housework
right.
and childcare. We want to go to work, please,
right.
you know, and it's good for you too. And men took that seriously and started, you know, think about this.
Yeah, yeah.
Think about your own husband. Think
yeah.
about
compared to my father, right?
Or compared
exactly.
to, you know, my father had to fought and lost to be in the delivery room when I was born.
That explains a lot about you.
Well,
a nice feminist father.
Well, yeah. yes, but and he lost. They wouldn't let him in. Now, if the man is married to the woman who is giving birth to the child,
he's not there. He's a jerk, right?
95% of men are there,
right?
Right. Think of how it's changed.
Right.
Men are far more involved in mm-hmm. child care, far more involved, and kind of like it. So okay. So what happened since the 70s so this is why there was a trickle of stuff about fatherhood then. Mm-hmm. That grew into a veritable ocean of positive stuff and all mm-hmm. these, you know, these beautiful pens to involve daddyhood and, mm-hmm. you know, and all the stuff, you know, daddy and me stuff. I mean, it's great.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was that those men became more involved, more active fathers, and the laws didn't change.
Yeah,
the court system thinks of them as our father's generation.
Right,
the
right.
court system thinks of them as wallets.
Right.
The court
right.
system thinks of them as utterly uninvolved, married to their jobs, and it doesn't acknowledge that they have more inputs.
Right.
So when they come to a custody decision, they feel like, why did I put in all this work and all this effort and all of this stuff with only to lose everything? Now, a little reality is helpful here
mm-hmm.
because the majority of custody cases are not contested.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a case where I want joint and you want sole.
Mm-hmm.
It is a case most of the time, and in fact, about over 80% of cases,
mm-hmm.
the husband and wife who are divorcing agree on custody prior to the court date.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a
and agree in which direction? Like the wife has
usually,
primary custody.
Usually it's joint, or she has sole physical and mm-hmm. he has visitation.
Uh-huh.
But there are occasionally, you know, there are 1 out of 5 cases there really is some conflict. He wants joint, she wants sole. He wants sole, and she wants
right,
whatever.
Right.
He wants more
right.
than she wants
mm-hmm.
him to have.
Mm-hmm.
And in those cases, courts tend to side. I think much of the father rights data probably have some validity.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, the courts seem to side with her.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's. I mean, I have an analysis of that suggests that may not be all that wrong. There are a lot of different, there are a lot of cases, a lot of extenuating circumstances for all this. One doesn't know. There's all kinds of charges of, you know, a violence in the home, which is also quite pervasive. And there tends to be some correlation with those contested custody cases, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is that by and large, what the anger that fuels a lot of the father rights and men's rights group is a sense that we changed, the institutions haven't. And so they're furious at courts, at judges, as lawyers, but also at their ex-wives. So there is an anti-feminist strain, but it's not the whole thing.
Right.
And I think of all of the chapters of the book, I mean, I actually think that the father rights guys have a legitimate gripe.
Yeah, I've always suspected that somewhere in there is a legitimate gripe against courts that live in the men.
But on the other hand, all of the groups that I talk with in my book have a legitimate gripe. I think they're just delivering their angry mail to the wrong address.
A legitimate institutional gripe. How about
absolutely,
that? Right.
Absolutely.
There is some institution which hasn't met the current era or something like
right,
some institution
right.
which hasn't moved forward.
Born with a silver spoon up his nose. Bracelet by on the family name. He's got no soul and a feeble brain. He's a hurt boy. George Bush could do no wrong. A war during Vietnam. Yeah, better ways to spend his time. Like getting drunk and doing lines. Just a frat boy, frat boy, frat boy. George Bush, the corporate whore. He's gonna wage perpetual war. A flight suit with a padded schlong. King George says bring him on. He talks the talk, we can't walk the walk. King George, the chicken hawk.
Now, back to Angry White Men with sociologist Michael Kimmel.
The reason that I'm critical, of course, is I think that some of the in reversals of data and all that are simply loopy. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, but I do get their anger, especially the fathers, the angry dads, who think we changed, the institutions haven't, and that's wrong, and we've been badly done by. Mm-hmm. There's the aggrieved entitlement. We put in this stuff, we're entitled.
Right. There was the very funny quote you had in there by a kid, I think it was a friend of yours who'd been a supervisor or something, and a kid who said, you know, do you spend any time with your dad? Well, he's so busy working on his dad's rights movement that I never see him.
Yeah.
You know? So that was very funny. So I want to return to the rage against women, because you end on this very depressing chapter of this guy who comes and shoots up the women at his gym because he can't get a date. And, you know, there's a sense that there's this, like, toxic rage building. We'll end on a more hopeful note, I promise, but, like, that there's this toxic rage. So, you know, some of the emails you quote are, as I said, they're just kind of uncomfortable to read. You know, the emails of the men's rights guys or the sort of letters of the shooters, you know. Just the sense of, like, anger against women that's kind of hard to take. It's very bracing. And so, you know, what do you do with that? Like, where does that come from, and what do you do with that?
I think that I think that a lot of guys have felt personally sort of so buffeted by the changes in women's lives around sexual empowerment, around entering into the workplace, you know, that they feel kind of, I mean, I think that the emotions underneath the anger are that they feel confused and bereft and bewildered and just kind of like at sea. These are unstable emotions. They make you feel like you can't get your footing. You're in quicksand. And I think that anger is a way to sort of stabilize yourself. Now, in George Sodini's case, which he's the lead of the chapter on the angry men.
He's the one who shot up the women at the gym.
At the gym, right.
Yes.
And then in his testimony, he said he hadn't had sex in years. He hadn't even had a date. There's all these gorgeous women. He's not a bad looking guy. He's not a bad looking guy. If you ever looked at his picture.
He says, I wear cologne. I mean, it's such a depressing letter.
It is. It really breaks your heart. Mm-hmm. That, you know, and a lot of guys, you know, think about all of those angry white men who are learning to be successful pickup artists, right? Think about this whole genre of how to become a pickup artist, how to like get women to, you know, and I remember when I was a kid that, you know, there were these like pheromone-based colognes that if you put them on, women couldn't stay away.
Right.
Guaranteed, you know, money back guarantee if you don't, get some tonight.
Right.
You know, and all of the strategies. A friend of mine has done some research on how guys prepare for, you know, going out to bars and stuff with their friends.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, because how do you go out to a bar in which the chances of you actually having sex that night with someone you pick up are you know, less than 5%?
Mm-hmm.
How do you prepare for failure every single weekend?
Right.
You know, and you know, so there's a kind of resentment, a kind of anger, you know, and then there's all this confusion stuff because, look, women have refused to sacrifice their hotness and their femininity for being competent in the workplace.
Right.
They want to be taken seriously as women and as workers. So, you know, they're beautiful, they're sexy, they're hot, now they tell us they like sex. How come not me?
Right,
you know,
right.
So I get that. I can understand that anger. And I feel that that guys feel like a resentment.
The odd thing is it's like infantilized. I mean, there were two things that struck me about Sodini's letter. One is that you read it and what he's saying incorrectly, but what you see his logic is, I'm doing everything I need to do to be a man and it's not working. Like that's the fundamental truth of his life.
That's right.
You know, and it's all superficial what he's saying. I'm wearing this, I'm working out, I'm doing this, I, you know, looking for a job, I'm doing all these things and it's utterly failing.
And I'm doing all these things that you women told me I have to do if I'm going to
You know, it's like that
chance.
Chevrolet commercial that I quote in my book in the that ran in the Super Bowl one year where you had these silent men and they say, like, I've picked up your laundry, you know, I've held your lipstick, I've, you know, it's mute. It's like the men are completely frozen and mute.
Narrated by Dexter.
Yeah, it's like, and you jerks, you know, you jerks, like you've done all this to me.
And for this, I get to drive a souped up 1970s car.
Exactly.
Muscle car.
the other thing,
just to let you know, just one thing, this is how I know that this commercial did not necessarily work on you because it wasn't for a Ford.
Right.
It was a Dodge.
It's a Dodge.
Dodge Challenger.
My mom had a Dodge Challenger. A gold Dodge Challenger. The other thing about the letter, I mean, you're supposed to get over that in like middle school, right? That's a very, you know, my husband has said that, oh God, when I was in middle school, you know, you always felt like the girls had something and you couldn't have. That is
That's
a legitimate
right.
feeling. It's just you're not supposed to have it when you're 40. You know, you're supposed to understand the world in a slightly more sophisticated way. I mean, that's the other thing that struck me as sad about his letter. It's like the thoughts of a 14-year-old boy, not the thoughts of a 40-year-old man.
Let me just take that for a second. Let's take the 40-year-old man and put him back 26 years.
Mm-hmm.
26 years ago, he was right.
Right.
No.
Right.
26 years ago, a 40-year-old would have been right to think those things.
Yeah. Right.
You see what I'm saying? That basically, you're right to say this.
Right.
That he embraced at 14 the idea that when I'm 40, I will have all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And now so it's regressive. Yes, a lot of this stuff is atavistic and regressive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of the guys I quote in the beginning of the book, all this, they're taking away our country.
Right.
And it's very nostalgic, atavistic, but he was right 24 years ago.
Right, right.
That seems to me to be a key.
Right.
Things have changed that quickly.
Right,
so
right.
you can't rely on, you're not Don Draper.
Right,
right,
right.
Don Drapers don't exist any longer.
Yes, Don Draper can go to work, put on perfume, look good, and he will get the many girls.
And it's not necessarily
going to work.
That's right.
Right, we only have a few minutes left, so I want to end. This is the hardest part. Everyone asks me this about my book. You know, you've got these men who are failing, who are angry. The kind of what can you do question. You know, we all race through that at the end of the book. Like, what can you do when you've got this sort of like bubbling, seething rage on the radio and on online and sort of in life and with Ramp? What do you do with all of this? How do you address these men? They are genuinely, I think, suffering and kind of falling off the map in many, many ways, you know, as fathers, as workers, in all sorts of ways. So they may not be right. They may not be entitled to their entitlement, and yet they are suffering. So what, you know, a couple of things that they can do.
I think this is really important because it also defines both of our posture. Mm-hmm. You know, you and I disagree somewhat in some respects, but we also run on parallel lines. And one of the things that I think is similar between your book and mine is that we both have a significant amount of compassion mm-hmm. for these guys who are suffering. Mm-hmm. We recognize that. Mm-hmm. What I say is that their pain is real, mm-hmm. but it's not necessarily true. Mm-hmm. That is, they are feeling real feelings. Mm-hmm. And anger, of course, is the one feeling men are allowed to feel, right? Mm-hmm. So they are feeling real feelings, but their analysis of why they're feeling it does not match up with what I understand to be the data.
So how do you turn that ship? Like, how do you convince these guys it's not the black woman who stole your job?
Well, there's two ways one can do this. First of all, look, it's a done deal, mm-hmm. right? Do you think that women are going to have some V8 moment where they're going to go, oh my God.
Gotta go back home.
This
right.
voting, working, you know, right. driving cars, having orgasms, forget that. Let's go back to the way it used to be. No.
Nor are the corporations going to be like, oh man, you're right. We should have left that factory in Alabama. You know?
That's right. That's not happening.
Right.
Exactly. That's a good point.
Yeah.
So the ship sailed.
Right.
So the question is, are we going to get on board or mm-hmm. are we going to swim after it? Mm-hmm. Right. The ship has sailed. Now, here is where I think we have something to offer. Mm-hmm. The data on men who, you know, because most, this is a very, in some ways, I'm making it a big movement, mm-hmm. right? But it's actually a declining number of men. Mm-hmm. Because most men, you know, maybe your husband, in fact, most of my friends have very quietly accommodated themselves mm-hmm. to greater gender equality in their relationships, in their families. And you know what? They don't hate it. In fact, they like it. Mm-hmm. They like having somebody to talk to who's smart and interesting and engaged. They like having those kinds of relationships with mm-hmm. their kids. They're actually feeling better about themselves. Men who share housework and childcare are more likely to go to the doctor for routine screenings. Mm-hmm. There's a men's health thing, mm-hmm. but less likely to end up in the ER, mm-hmm. less likely to go to therapists, less likely to be diagnosed with depression.
So
their children are less likely to be diagnosed with ADHD. Uh-huh. So here's what I would uh-huh. say. The answer to your question, in a sense, is on the one hand, the deal's done. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know what? It's actually better. Mm-hmm. Your life will improve. Now, that's on the personal side. On the political side, I think we have to say, what are the institutional structural constraints that have prevented us from living the lives we want to live? Mm-hmm. How about adequate health care?
Right.
How about universal child care for our children so that our wives, you know...
They would like laugh in your face.
Of
about
course they would.
Right.
Of course they would.
They just have to get used to them, I guess, you know?
But my feeling is, you know, if enough of us keep saying this, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, you know, and I'm sure that this is part of what was happening on those backyards last weekend, mm-hmm. You know, the likely next mayor of the city of New York has proposed universal child care mm-hmm. to be paid for by taxing the wealthy. Mm-hmm. You know, okay, probably won't happen,
right.
but it's on the agenda. Someone's talking about it. It's going to increase. Eventually, we're going to end up looking a little bit more like the rest of Europe, like the rest of the industrial world.
I mean, I actually personally put a lot of faith in the personal, the slow, gradual personal experience.
Me too.
You watch TV, you see a lot of guys taking care of their children much more
right.
than there was 2 or 3 years ago. You know, it's on mainstream sitcoms. You know, everyone has their show, guys with kids, you
yes.
know, whatever. So you see that, it seems more normal. You're out of work and you end up picking your kids up from school. Situation of a lot of
right.
men these days. So you just like slowly acclimate. Like culturally, we slowly acclimate.
And more of us. So all I'm saying is that in the corporation to say that you want on-site childcare, mm-hmm. we've always thought of that as a women's issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's not.
Right.
It's a parents' issue.
Right.
You know, when men come out as parents, we're going to say, here's what I want. Mm-hmm. I want that. And of course, women won't get it unless men mm-hmm. support it too. I'm saying that this is in our greater gender equality is actually in men's interest.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different argument than saying, you know, give it up, guys, because the ship sailed. I mean, that may be true, but I want men to feel motivated toward this. I think that, as you say, the quiet accommodation is the biggest trend.
Mm-hmm.
And as the most dominant one, it has that kind of rippling effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's terrific because you see that in all over the country that men are far more, all over the country. This isn't a red or blue state or even mm-hmm. a purple state thing. This is across the board, men are spending more time with their kids. They're more valuing them. So again, you know, in parentheses, the courts are going to have to recognize this eventually.
So let's end on that wonderfully optimistic note. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks,
congratulations
Hannah.
On your book.
Great. Thank you.
I was born between factory walls. I was conceived among the ivory halls. And in this world I knew my role. I went to work with a single goal. I traveled the earth to far off lands, from the Asian jungles to the African sands. I flew in planes of camouflage green before I settled upon this sea. Like a shooting star, I came to rest. And this farmer's field is where I nest, watching the seasons come and go, watching the long grass grow and grow. By and I lay here still, for my purpose is clear for me to fulfill. The sun was out, it was the middle of May, when the farmer's three children came out to play. They ventured near, I lay in wait. One unknowing step sealed their fate. 1,000 shards of plastic rose from where I lay and through their clothes into their bodies. The shrapnel sank here in this field by a river bank. The blood poured down, shone in the sun, and one cluster bomblet's job was done.
Now, messages from Access Sacramento.